Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you have something to say and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details, or contact us at PR@speakuptalkradio.com. Well, today's guest is huge in terms of life experiences and accomplishments. And I could begin with the typical. Dr. Michael Bernhardt has over 20 years of experience directing successful social development programs, primarily in public health. He is an acknowledged authority in program evaluation and quality improvement of healthcare, and is recognized for his contributions to expanding access to healthcare, system strengthening, behavior change, policy reform, community promotion, and training innovations. Or I could share a bit of what he said to me. He said, I have a genuinely exciting life, shot at by age 12 in Iran, evacuated from a hostile country, again in Iran, at age 13, beaten by a gang of communist goons at age 17 in the Philippines, two more evacuations from crumbling security situations in Indonesia and Jordan, United States Air Force pilot of high-performance aircraft, lived in 14 countries and worked in 50, plus failed marriages and multiple firings for being a smartass. And the list could go on, and so could I, but I would rather hear directly from him. So welcome to the network, Dr. Michael Bernhardt.
You've described a fascinating person, Pat. I hope one day to meet that person. I think that's Pinocchio's version, but I'm grateful to you for it. Very pleased to be with you today.
Thank you. It is my pleasure. And the last time we spoke, we had perhaps one too many mint juleps while celebrating the Kentucky Derby, and we danced around so many subjects, dirty surgical instruments and fake pharmaceuticals and cats and horses. So today, I hope it's still early for us and that we should be able to focus singularly on your books and writing. Yes?
I look forward to it.
All right, good.
How do you want to proceed?
All right. You've written four novels that you class as psychological thrillers, the Max Brown Tetralogy, and you're working on your fifth. What moves you after such an exciting lifetime of adventure? What moves you to write these?
Narcissism, like every other budding author. we're all appealing for attention, but we don't know how to get it. For the wallflowers at parties and sitting in front of our word processors, this is about the best we can do. I'd like to make one correction. It's a philosophical thriller. And sadly, it's become such a popular label, and you'll pick up one of these so-called psychological thrillers, and they're pretty short on psychology, other than a few lame attempts to pin some psychological motives on the perp towards the end. But it's an abused, promiscuously abused term. The philosophical thriller is pretentious. There's no question about that. It's perhaps an attempt to provide some marketing differentiation, but there are some big issues. And you're asking what motivates a person to write. I think there are two. You know, there's the poor, forlorn soul who hopes that it'll become commercially successful. And I say poor, forlorn because 1 million books, 1 million novels, Pat, come out in this country every single blessed year. That's 2,700 new novels every day. Now, granted, most of them are awful. But if even 1% of them are good, that's 10,000 books, so there's stuff out there for the reading public. But standing out in a crowd of 1 million is not easy. So commercial success is a long way away for most people. The statistics I've seen is that the average sales of a self-published book are shy of 250 over the lifetime of the book. That's pretty low, and you're not going to make a lot of money if Amazon is giving you a buck, buck and a half for each one you sell. The other reason, of course, that I alluded to before is that a person really genuinely wants to do something different with their life and say something, whether it's commercially viable or not. I went in that direction and came up with, or essentially, I guess three skeins run through the series of books. One is the life stages of the Homo Americanus, you know, the American male, poor embattled creature that he is. Manhood used to be a birthright. Now it just seems to be a series of challenges for those of us who are facing the end game and wondering what we've accomplished. The second is the nature of evil, and thirdly, conversely, the nature of God. And you can't get much more pretentious than that. But hell, Herman Melville picked it up. Why shouldn't I? All right, your turn to talk.
As you were saying that, I was thinking you probably couldn't have written these as a younger man.
No, yeah. I could not. Yeah. And for two very simple reasons. One, they do track the life cycle, the life stages of an American male, and it's helpful to have lived those. And the second is, you know, you accumulate a lot of experiences along the way, no matter what you're doing. You know, I had the good fortune to travel a lot, but that's not necessarily a prerequisite for putting something entertaining on paper. The Khmer Rouge figure large in the fourth novel. Evil, nobody can do evil like they can, but they are still alive, well, kicking in Western Cambodia. Drug counterfeiting was a big problem and continues to be in Cambodia, and that was one of the problems that I had to try to deal with one of the programs that I was running in the country. So I had some knowledge basis for addressing these issues and also some sense of how a person might react viscerally when they had to deal with them. So yeah, mm-hmm. Earlier life, it would have been different books. I'd like to say they have more depth as a consequence of this experience. But I think it's safe to say they're different.
Yeah, exactly. That experience really comes into play. And so you make a conscious effort to weave these bigger questions into your books. For you, for your readers, why do you think that these specific skeins, as you call them, life stages of the American male and evil and the nature of God, why do you think that is of interest to the reader?
Well, for one reason, they're durable. They fascinated people for a long time. The nature of God goes back to our very earliest, you know, to the earliest recordings, written word that we have. And one of the issues there that has come back again and again. It started with Epicurus. Gosh, when was that? Before the birth of Christ is theodicy. The theodicy is this paradox, Pat, that plagues, I think, all the major religions. On the one hand, we have an omnibenevolent, all-caring, all-knowing, all-powerful God. Sounds great. But then you look around you, and this all-benevolent God is presiding over a universe that's just convulsed with evil. How do you square these two things? Mm-hmm. And this has been a problem, theodicy, that has entertained writers for a long time in religion. Some of them talk about the need, well, you've got to have free will, right? So that man can make his own mistakes. So I think that's, you know, the durability issues. This is something that's gone on forever. I mentioned Melville. He didn't take up theodicy, but he did take up the nature of evil. And then I think the other thing that underpinned, you know, the other theme that seems to be consistently interesting is the changing role of people in our society. And that's the whole maturation or life stages of men in our society. Mm-hmm. Perhaps not as entertaining a topic as it was, or not as saleable a topic as it was a few years ago. I think there's still people who are looking at those things and trying to come up with answers.
Right.
I hasten to add, before you get a word in edgewise, I didn't come up with any answers. I just tried to present the questions in different ways.
Well, I think that's what it's all about. You really don't want to tell people what to think. You just want them to. So hopefully your book challenges them to put these thoughts in their mind and think about them. And so let's talk about your books, the Max Brown Tetralogy, which traces the arc from age 10 through 66 of a man who earnestly tries to avoid trouble, but whose behavior or events repeatedly lands him in it. The first one, actually, they all have some extremely interesting titles, and I want to talk about the title selection in a bit. But book one, How I Made $3.2 million from My Hobby, let's talk about the first one.
All right. What do you want to know? Going right back on you.
Give us a little sneak peek into the book. So tease the reader. Why would they want to pick up the book?
I think they want to pick up the book because I need the sales. but beyond that, this is debut novels are tough. You know, they come out of somebody who's been collecting ideas for a long period of time, and by God, they're going to get it all into one 400-page book. And it's a rare debut novel that works. And I've been working on mine, as a consequence, for a long time, trying to get it right. But the book itself, to address your question, is about a kid who's burdened with a sissy name, Maxwell Smythe Brown the Fourth. A fictitious name. His father added Fourth on the birth certificate and two in the Smythe for reasons that are obscure to young Max, but it puts him in constant hot water as a kid. You know, he's Smythe the Fourth or Smythe the Fart, if I can say that on your podcast. And so to counteract, you know, he's always in danger of being ostracized, certainly ridiculed. So he becomes a smartass, a tough kid. He's always getting in fights, you know, trying to prove that he's one of the gang. And this sticks with him for life. And only over the course of the four books is he able to slowly extinguish this behavior because, you know, it works against you. People who do this typically are insecure, and Max is insecure. He goes to Vietnam. He's thrown into a very bad job. The loss rate, the death rate of pilots is 55%. This is in the RF-101C. He gets out of it alive, comes back, goes to grad school, because you can go to grad school if you've been to Vietnam. Universities at that time looking for applicants who were not seeking a draft deferment. And Max is one of those, as was I, by sheer coincidence. He marries a fabulously beautiful woman, and she brings the sort of baggage that beautiful women sometimes bring with them. She's unsuited for marriage, and he winds up, he makes some mistakes, winds up in Bangladesh, where he gets on the track of a treasure, because he's taken up a pretentious hobby of ancient map collecting, which leads him to gets him closer and closer to a map, to a treasure, and he stumbles into it. The marriage falls apart. He remarries, or he finds a new woman. It has a more or less happy ending, and I think people expect that at the beginning. But he's constantly getting himself into hot water because he just can't keep either his mouth zipped or his fly zipped. And that pretty much, I think, takes care of the first book. There's a lot in there about ancient maps, which some people may find educational. There's a lot in there about Vietnam, which I think some people find educational, and some men of my generation find a little bit challenging. Survivor's guilt, I assume.
Right.
And that's enough about the first book. Right. It's a debut novel. It's ambitious. It's getting better with each rewriting. I think people should read the third and the fourth one first because they're much more polished professional work.
Mm-hmm. Obviously grown as you're writing.
By mistakes.
Yeah. So when you were writing this first book, did you know you wanted it to be a series, or was this just you pouring out as much as you could?
Well, actually, it was pouring out. Like so many of these ventures, this started in 1986 when I actually was in Bangladesh. I was in a bad job. I was in it's a difficult living situation. Had a bad boss. My primary relationship was not good. What I could do was sit down at a word processor at 8 o'clock at night, and what I put down was bitter, self-aggrandizing, and that's tough to come back from. I picked the book up, or I came back to the book 30 years later, and what I found was unlikable characters, and I've been trying to correct that ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And they are now likable characters, but there's still more work, I think, in this book.
All righty. So let's move on to book two, How Ornithology Saved My Life, the second book of the Max Brown group. So just give us a little peek into that. Obviously, you pick up where you left off, and where does he land?
Well, yeah, Max is moving into new life stages. You know, he's gone through the first ones of proving that he's a man, and by conventional measures, he's gone to Vietnam, he has a trophy wife, or a beautiful wife, not a trophy at that time. In the second book, now there's impending fatherhood. There is concern that he seems to attract bad things to him, and much of the work is trying to counter those two feelings that he has. The one, he's bad news for people around him because bad things happen to them, and they do. The body count's pretty significant. Yeah, there is. You know, how do you become a father? There's not a lot written about that. If you go to the parenting show at Barnes & Noble, it's mostly directed at the, quote, primary caregiver, unquote, mom. And if there's anything about fathers, it's typically written by Dave Barry or another humorous. And the message there is, you know, you're irrelevant. It's an honorific, but no one's going to pay any attention to you. And that's, I think, the tenor of those. But he's in Holland with his wonderful new soulmate, taking refuge from people who are trying to kill them. Birds figure in, and do airplanes, because I retained my interest. I still fly. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to bring that in and provide a reasonably accurate account of what it's like to be in a small airplane.
Interesting. So that helps us understand the title.
How ornithology, there's a very interesting bird. It's up at this airport I fly out of. It's called a killdeer. It's one of the plover family. Well, they fake injury. They're ground nesting birds, so they're very vulnerable to predators. Its tactic is that one of the birds will draw predators away from the nest by faking an injury as it staggers off while a predator chases this ailing bird. And as the predator is closing for the kill, miraculous recovery, the killdeer flaps off to safety. And I think it's unique in that regard, my ornithology not being good enough to make that statement with any confidence. But it's a tactic that the principal character in the book learns about, and he didn't need to learn about it, but he uses it again and again to draw their adversaries away from his wife.
So fascinating. I love this. Now we move to speleology, restored my sex life. We're going from birds to caves here. So give us a peek into that third book.
We're fatherhood on steroids. The couple has two very precocious 9-year-old twins who, like some twins, create their own sort of hermetically sealed social network. The parents are useful, but their approval is not absolutely necessary. And so raising these two little hellions is one of the central features of the book. But the other is, and I've been playing down the evil bit, but it comes up very strongly here. I live in North Georgia, where the Ku Klux Klan is still a force to be reckoned with. It has its members, but it also has just a lot of supporters. So the book finds Max and his wife. The daughters want to look for buried treasure. The Klansmen are looking for the same buried treasure. And, accurately enough, there's quite a lot of buried treasure in northern Georgia. Georgia was famous for gold production after 1828, and that's what led to the Cherokee getting kicked off their land and sent to Oklahoma, the discovery of gold. And I think this face of evil here is, it arises a little bit out of ideology, white supremacy, but I also tie it into, you know, people who don't feel very good about themselves. And so they're looking to hang it on something. Vietnam comes back. One of them suffering from a dose of PTSD. But I think white supremacists are not terribly confident about who they are and what the rightful place is in the world. And this is a useful crutch to them, although it's tough on everybody else, particularly minorities. So a large part of the book deals with that.
All right, so these books are really causing your readers to stop and think. I mean, the whole nature of evil, that theme that just runs through all of them, gives them quite a bit to think about, and then that gets carried on into book 4, How Existentialism Almost Killed Me.
And the titles very loosely are related to what's in the book. I quote Kierkegaard from time to time because he's handy. He says things like, boredom is the source of all evil. Or the gods were bored, that's why they created humans. You know, you throw these little lines in from time to time. In the fourth book, it's the Khmer Revolution. God, darn it, nobody's ever done evil the way those have. I think they beat the Nazis. The Nazis provided a little bit of medical attention, but very little, to their victims. And if you were a Jew in a Nazi-occupied territory, you knew you were holding a bad hand. But the Khmer Rouge, nobody knew. And they provided medical attention to patch up folks so that they could torture them some more. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't put them them out of their misery. So points to the Nazis on that. And they're really atrocious. And they killed off a fourth of the population of Cambodia during the 4 years that they were in power. 17,000 people. There's this infamous prison in Phnom Penh, Pat, called Toll Sleng. 17,000 people went in. Seven came out. And I'm not saying 7,000. I'm saying seven.
Oh, man.
People survived. So, you know, just, and they were tortured for months. The guards' major preoccupation was preventing suicides.
Oh.
So, you know, just horrendous, horrendous people. And they've been, the remnants have been given a pass by the current Cambodian government. Well, the current and forever. The dictatorship that will always be in power, I suspect.
Right.
Hun Sen. And they're alive and well in Western Cambodia, and they use children in mines for slavery. Well, they don't pay them at all. They just send them down. There's rubies and sapphires in that region. So they provide the perfect foil. In the book, they've gone into drug counterfeiting. And as I said before, that's a real problem in much of the world, certainly in Southeast Asia. And it's lucrative. Organized crime is in it. Recent samples of counterfeit drugs have found heroin. So this is apparently, these things are apparently being manufactured in the same factories as hard drugs. It's big and rough business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's estimated that 45% of the drugs, well, WHO says 45% of the drugs that are in international trade going across state national boundaries are bad. Just really a frightening number. And so our reluctant heroes, Max and Sally Brown, to give them a name, find themselves through a series of errors put on the trail of these people. And again, the body count is high. And I think it's an entertaining book. People like the fact that some of it takes place in a brothel, nothing saucy there. Some of it takes place on elephant back where the battle is waged. In Southeast Asia, I think, is an interesting place in and of itself. There's a visit to Angkor Wat, the elephant sanctuary near Lampang in Thailand. But people do write in and say, like the travelogue part. So there's more of that in the future.
Wow, these are just stunning books. As you're speaking, there's no reason why everyone wouldn't want to pick this one up. How Existentialism Almost Killed Me. I love this.
Well, thank you. And that's where you come in. You're not picking them up because they don't know about them.
And your covers are quite interesting as well.
Are they?
Yes, they are. Just talk about your cover selection. How did you go about deciding? Because I can't imagine the thought that had to go into, like, what kind of a cover do I put on these?
A lot of that was sitting in front of a computer, tugging on my forelock, hot tears of desperation running down my cheeks. Cover design is really a bugger. It's tough, as other people may have told you. Yeah, I had a lot of help with the fourth one, Tara Weiss, who's another author here who writes very entertaining books, helped me with that one. There's an animal on each cover. And that does seem to have eye appeal. Perhaps a golden retriever would be better, given what we see on television ads. The idea is to very loosely link what's going on in the book. There are elephants in the fourth book. There are birds in the second book. There are pigeons in the first book. They're always harbingers of bad news in the first book. Try to keep that theme going. In terms of the title, I'm not sure I did a good job. I appreciate your support on that. The speleology title has been a showstopper for some people because they don't recognize the word.
Mm-hmm.
And so they take a pass at that point. And tell me so. I didn't pick it up because I didn't know what it's about. It's one of those provisional titles you put on something, you copyright it, and say, holy cow, this was a placeholder. What am I doing here? But by that time, it's published and kind of stuck with it.
Now you got to stick with your decision.
Bad as it may have been.
Oh my gosh, your characters! I know we're getting close to running on time here, but I'm fascinated with your character development process. Max and his women and the characters—do they follow your lead, or do you follow them?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I haven't, you know, I don't have a lot of insight into that. Some of the characters good, universally admired is Ronnie in the third book, the amiable Scott who's dedicated his life to clearing minds. landmines. I think what happens in these, like a lot of people who are trying to write, you know where you want to end. You know, you want to know what the last, you pretty much know what the last line is like. And then you set out on the adventure with your characters, and it's more fun to write about fun characters, right? You don't write about your third grade teacher because, in my case, she wasn't very interesting. You invent people, and that's the fun. I think, you know, I think going off topic, but I think people who like to write, you asked this before in a different way, they like to make stuff up. They like to lie, right?
Yes.
And it's too late for me to go to law school and become a lawyer, so that avenue of lying is gone. Too thin-skinned to become a politician, so to be able to invent and make stuff up, I've had to become a writer. And you can make up characters, people you'd like to sit and have a drink with at a bar or have live next door to you. But, you know, those types of people. It's one of the entertainments, of course. I think it really contributes to a more enjoyable book for the reader.
No, I get that. I get that. It puts you in control. You're in charge, and you can make up whatever you want. No one knows where it's coming from, and it doesn't matter.
Dang, too.
Now, you're also working now on book 5. Is it a follow-up to this, or is it completely different?
It's both. I thought I'd close it off at 4, but there's something I've always wanted to work on, and that's honor killings and honor crimes. When I was in Jordan, I had a little, fairly sizable public health program directed at women. And women were being killed, and they were having acid thrown on them in the name of honor. And I took a flyer at that in my program, and then I backed away. I went on to work on domestic abuse. But the honor crime thing is just such a landmine, and for me with my shiny white face and American backing to go into that was not going to get very far. But about anywhere between 5 and 22,000 women are killed in the name of honor every year.
Wow.
And countless more are the victims of acid attacks. So that's what the book is about. We're in the final stages of Max and Sally's life. In fact, it's very much hers because she's diagnosed with liver cancer. In the early pages, she needs a donor, and this ties the honor killings, the honor crimes, and the red market as the trade in illicit organs is referred to. This ties the two together. There are people in Switzerland who are harvesting organs from women, acid attack victims who have come for reconstructive surgery. The kidney is taken out of them, they survive, or if more organs are needed, they don't survive. And there's really, since they're honor victims, and honor, I should emphasize, is always in quotes, because it's anything but honor.
Right.
So honor victims, there's not a family to really follow up and show an interest in what happens to them. They go to Switzerland, they disappear, fine, that's what we wanted all along. And that's the gist, and it's a tough book to write. The other books have a lot of humor in them, and I want to emphasize that to anyone who's listening, that they're funny books. People chuckle a lot. When you've got cancer, you've got organ harvesting, you've got honor killings and acid attacks, humor's tough to work in.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Where are these acid attacks happening? What areas?
Oh, well, throughout the world. It is fortunately not happening often on our continent. It seems to be in Middle Eastern, North African, African thing. And they're different. An honor killing is a family decision. You know, somebody in the family, a woman, I mean, you have to have the going in position is you have to place an extremely low value on a woman's life. Then anything is possible, right? She doesn't count. And if the family decides in consultation, particularly the men, that a woman, a member of the family, has done something that is shameful to the family, then she's got to be exorcised out. That is different from the acid attack. This typically arises from some sort of feelings of sexual inferiority, a cuckold, or somebody who is unsure of his sexual appeal, or someone who's been rejected. The response in many of these cases, far too many of these cases, I should say, is to disfigure the woman. Mm-hmm. You don't want me? Okay, damn it. No one's going to want you.
Right.
And they're so common, and they're very problematical because it's hard to get, the woman goes underground, very often, and time is of the essence, and starting up repairs on her face and chest and wherever the acid has landed.
These are things most people are not even aware of.
I think there's things that we would all like not to be aware
of. This is true, yes.
Actually, they're out there.
Wow.
And it's a tough book to write. I'm at page 200, and I don't know where to go next.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. Yeah, that would be very painful to write. Well, we will just stay tuned to see where you land with that and let us know and keep us posted, and we'll make that available.
I'd be happy to do so.
Yeah, when it comes about. All right, my friend, we're going to begin to wrap up. We've talked a bit about your books. I know you are such a fascinating human being. There's so much more to learn.
I wish. From
you. No, you really are. You've just been and done so many things in your life that we can go off on all kinds of tangents, but...
I would say the following. Give the indie books a chance. You know, when the big publishing houses talk about quality control, but you get a lot of McNovels out there. Things that are written to formula, and the problem with these... The second problem is, you don't get any revisions until the last remainders table has been cleared. With the indie novel, a self-published novel, let's put it that way, I can republish this thing every couple of days if I get feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So we play the successive approximation games, and if I work on it long, and all the other self-publishers work on it long enough and pay attention to constructive feedback, ultimately something good is going to come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say first, you know, don't slavishly go to Patterson. These are formulaic and reportedly being written by his minions, not by James Patterson himself.
Mm-hmm.
This is not to say these are not entertaining books. You can spend time with them, but I'd kind of put them in the McNovel category. Mm-hmm. If you've read one, you've pretty much read them all. So get out there and take a look at the independents, because there are some nuggets. And I think the only way to really find them is to go to blog sites and to follow up on leads like you're providing, so that people can make some kind of an assessment in advance and weed out the chaff, because there's a hell of a lot of it. Again, 2,700 books coming out every day. They're not all good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think we found some nuggets with you here. So,
bless your heart and go to heaven for saying that.
Send us to the places where folks can learn more about you and where they can purchase these books.
Well, Amazon, of course, Michael Bernhardt, spelled B-E-R-N-H-A-R-T, has them. Goodreads has them. There's a hardcover version available on Barnes & Noble. Go to any of those. And one entry point would be my publisher's website, my publisher being me, which is huffpublishing.com. And Huff is H-O-U-G-H Publishing. H-O-U-G-H Publishing. And I assume there'll be written material that will accompany this podcast,
mm-hmm,
that people could look at that as well, right, Pat?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, we will.
Excellent. Excellent.
We will have that on our website. Links to Huff Publishing, HOUGH Publishing.com. We'll have pictures of your books and links back to your site so that people can find you. You are an amazing person. I just so enjoyed talking with you. And we're going to have to do this again. Any final words before we head out?
Buy the third and fourth book. I'll get the first one right pretty soon. The second one is a potboiler. The third and fourth, I think the last book has received all 5-star reviews so far on Amazon. So if someone by accident or by cajolery actually picks it up, they like it. And so I can recommend that. The third book's done almost as well. So those two are good starting points. Even though it's a series, they're standalone.
All right, so the third book is How Speleology Restored My Sex Drive, and book four was How Existentialism Almost Killed Me. So those are the two to start with. Dr. Michael Bernhardt, thank you so much for today. We need to do this again.
Well, thank you, Pat. You're a polished interview. I really enjoyed talking with you.